In a pamphlet called Common Sense, published in the lead-up to the American Revolution, Thomas Paine wrote, "Men who look upon themselves born to reign and others to obey soon grow insolent. Selected from the rest of mankind, their minds are early poisoned by importance. And the world they act in differs so materially from the world at large that they have but little opportunity of knowing its true interests. And when they succeed to the government, they are frequently the most ignorant and unfit of any throughout the dominions." Isn't it funny how history seems to repeat itself over and over and over? We're constantly being told we're progressing as a people, and yet we keep finding ourselves locked in the repetition of certain cycles, as if we are doomed to repeat moments in time where imbalances were not properly worked out. Anyone who has studied history in depth knows all too well that it is a long and painful process. The British monarchy and its coronation rituals have an interesting history. Rituals which have been recently described as the last religious monarchical coronation rites in the West. But what they're not saying is that the British coronation ceremony is one of the most powerful symbols modern humanity has of the union between church and state. In America, this unholy union was permanently separated in the enshrinement of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Our Bill of Rights effectively built a wall between church and state in the very first of the amendments, which is first for a reason. As one of its co-authors, Thomas Jefferson, explained, that reason has to do with the reality that spirituality is a matter that should lay directly and solely between a person and God, as is every person's inherent natural rights, with no middlemen, and especially no government of middlemen. We were talking about a time where in the not-too-distant past, ecclesiastical judges were determining what heresy is and then burning people at the stake for it. And today, if we had no First Amendment, I'm sure most of you can only imagine what beliefs would be required in order to not be burned at the stake. So, everything in this place we all share seeks equilibrium. This pull to balance energetic imbalances is inherent to the reality within which we exist and can be seen as a repeating pattern everywhere. As inequality grows all around the world, by the day, by the very second, deep contemplation of those ancient rites and symbols which seek to legitimize and formally enshrine inequality becomes crucial, perhaps now more than ever in modern human history.
Saying we are going to kowtow to them and we are going to bend and bow and kneel to them. Those days are done. The monarchy is a relic.
For those who are not familiar, King Charles III's upcoming coronation ceremony, a highly symbolic religious initiation ritual for a hereditary monarchy system that openly claims a divine right by God as its basis of power to rule over 2.4 billion subjects that are now under the British Commonwealth, will be the most viewed coronation ever in the modern known history of the crowning of a king or queen. It will be viewed by billions of people the world over. The coronation is taken extremely seriously and has quantum layers of symbolic meaning built throughout the entire set of rituals.
We, therefore, the lords spiritual and temporal of this realm, and members of the House of Commons, together with other members of Her Late Majesty's Privy Council, and representatives of the realms and territories, aldermen and citizens of London, and others.
I was told yesterday by the police that I wasn't allowed to write that, and if I did, I'd be arrested.
Hereby, with one voice and consent of tongue and heart, proclaim that the Prince Charles Philip Arthur George is now become our only lawful and rightful liege lord, Charles III.
In other words, this is not anything even remotely close to your average St. Patrick's Day parade with the floats down Main Street where they throw a few pieces of candy to the kids on a Saturday morning. What this ceremony means, especially at this point in time in the space we as human beings all share, absolutely matters to the future of humanity as a whole, regardless of whether or not you consider yourself a loyal and obedient subject
to whom we do acknowledge all faith and obedience
of a royal crown placed on the heads of a single family automatically due to birthright. A crown upheld on a pillar is precarious in the 21st century as the hereditary principle of what is claimed to be, quote, royal blood. The circulation of social energy is the true function of government, one that has been abused time and again for the whole of its history. In the post-coronavirus reality we all share, many of us all around the world have become all too painfully aware of what it feels like to be subjected to an egregious imbalance in this social contract. The energy bestowed upon and invested in the king and the church/government he becomes the head of is supposed to be concentrated and returned back to the people in equal measure. I don't know if you guys know that just over 100 years ago, King George V, for example, would attend agricultural shows to give his blessing. The king would physically go, he would bless the people, bless their crops, bless their livestock. When Charles goes to an agricultural show, like he did earlier this summer, just by the way, he asks the farmers what they're doing to achieve net zero. Going back further just a few hundred years, it was literally believed that the monarch, by virtue of his God-given divinity as, quote, the Lord's anointed, could lay his hands upon the sick and cure them. It was called touching for the king's evil, and records of it date back to King Edward the Confessor, whose reign began in 1042. And the practice of it actually continued up until the 18th century. 3 centuries on, and now, according to British Heritage, accounts for the sovereign grant, which funds the monarchical household's official expenses, stated that subjects of the British Crown paid a whopping $102.4 million during 2021 to 2022 in order to fund the royals. That's a lot of financial energy of the average person in the kingdom being extracted and funneled up to the royal family. And it cannot be missed that we're living through a time when British citizens themselves are being told that they're going to have no choice but to pay a lot more for their energy this winter and beyond. It is now estimated that some 42% of British households may fall into what they're literally calling energy poverty this winter, leaving millions of the crown's subjects financially unable to afford to light and heat their own homes. And that's 2 years after coronavirus, corona and virus both coming from Latin, corona meaning crown and virus meaning poison, one can't help but notice. 2 years after coronavirus triggered the largest transfer of wealth from the masses up to the elite circles of power at the top of our modern society the world over. British Prime Minister Liz Truss recently declared the beginning of the new Carolian Age, something Britain hasn't seen since Charles II ruled back in the 17th century. And the new king didn't have to be called Charles III, just by the way. He actually has 4 names.
Prince Charles Philip Arthur George.
According to custom, he could have chosen any single one of those for his regnal name. But he chose Charles. Charles' deep symbolic ties to his 2 preceding royal namesakes go well beyond a shared name. His first wife, Princess Diana, was descended from not one but 2 of Charles II's illegitimate heirs. In other words, even if Charles III had not made it to the throne, his son William, who is next in line, is a blood descendant of Charles II. So in any case, this post-Elizabethan time period was inevitably going to be a Carolian age, regardless of whether Charles himself took the throne or not. And this isn't like when prospective parents flip through a baby name book and see what they like. These names are of extreme symbolic significance in their ties to the line and power of the monarchy, powerfully linking that country's past to its present. And it's interesting when you consider that his name will be said countless millions of times on a daily basis in the media and households everywhere.
King Charles I was first and foremost an absolute monarchist. He believed fully and completely in his divine, God-granted right to rule. He wielded supreme, autocratic authority, totally unrestricted, even according to the laws of his own kingdom.
I am the law!
During his coronation in 1626, which took place on February 2nd, chosen because it was known then as the Holy Day of Candlemas, the Archbishop asked Charles a series of questions for oaths, the final one being, "Sir, will you grant to hold and keep the laws and rightful customs which the commonalty of this, your kingdom, have?" Previous coronations had the word "chosen" at the end, as in, "the laws and rightful customs which your kingdom have chosen." But by removing that last word, Charles I was emphasizing the nuanced but critical fact that he believed his oaths were a contract with God alone and not with the people, signaling up front that he was not bound nor interested in what the people had, quote, chosen. Right from the start, it was made quite clear this was not going to be a representative form of government, but an absolute dictatorial one. And that's fundamentally the case. Years later, the American Declaration of Independence, levied against King George III, came infamously complete with a, quote, long train of abuses described as, quote, repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states, end quote. That included imposing taxes on people without their consent, as well as dissolving representative houses repeatedly for opposing the king's invasions on people's rights, and really just crossing all the borders and territories. The word tyranny was capitalized in that document, just by the way. Much of these long train of abuses are directly addressed in the first 10 amendments to the Bill of Rights, which seeks to secure people's natural inherent rights and enumerate them, point them out, in order to avoid a repeat of such tyrannies against them, the very kinds that came out of the kings of England that many of the people in the colonies had experienced in the course of events. But it was over 100 years earlier, in the year 1641, under King Charles I, that the Puritans and the British Parliament of the day drew up an unprecedented document they delivered to their king, and also printed and handed out for the people to read as well, titled The Grand Remonstrance, wherein they laid out in great detail and for quite a few more pages their version of the long train of abuses that they suffered under King Charles I's rule. As such, the Grand Remonstrance includes such grievances as the dissolution of Parliament multiple times. In fact, Charles I dissolved Parliament at one point for so long during his reign that the period is actually referred to in history as the 11 Years' Tyranny, wherein the king ruled over the nation from 1629 to 1640 without any Parliament at all, the longest such interval in modern English history. Again, Charles I considered his rule absolute, and believed himself personally ordained by God. Therefore, he could do whatsoever he pleased, with no one on earth to answer to but God himself, sometime in the afterlife, hypothetically. The later emphasis on checks and balances in our American system grew out of this very period when it all came to a head. Revolutionaries at the time would hear these stories from their grandfathers, other ancestors who actually were there in England and dealt with this stuff, and other people who heard about it generally from the time periods and passed down that information. People were on watch for it. And in that time, King Charles I raised a standing army among the people and quartered large numbers of troops all over the country. That's the Third Amendment of the Bill of Rights. He confiscated the arms of the trained citizen militias, then stockpiled all the country's gunpowder in the Tower of London, Second Amendment, and put a price so high on it that many people could not afford to purchase any, and thus effectively, he left people unable to defend themselves. See? The king violated the rights of habeas corpus, which we can recognize in Article 1, Section 9 of the U.S. Constitution, many other parts of history, and trial by jury, 6th and 7th Amendments of the Bill of Rights. The courts were loaded with judges and juries favorable to the crown who would do the king's bidding no matter what. Charles I also had people jailed without bail, effectively leaving some to die in prison for charges they were not allowed to even refute. Today we have the Sixth Amendment, which recognizes the problem of impartiality. Habeas corpus in particular has been protected in the English system since the Magna Carta of 1215, and he violated that. Then there's all the taxes, fees, and fines. Charles I dug up and then brought back some very ancient customs people had forgotten about as a way to find new means of taxing people. And in addition, he created brand new, never before heard of taxes like the quote ship money tax, which was placed on merchants. It was supposedly collected to help guard the seas, but then there were a bunch of cases of merchants unprotected and then attacked by Turkish pirates anyway. Charles I raised prices in the official book of rates in order to garner higher taxes on goods, so they were listed as more valuable than they were. Some of these were taxed to the point that the tax itself was literally more money than the goods that were being purchased, sold, traded. He sold monopolies for a premium to certain select producers of all kinds of common goods, salt, soap, leather, wine. And he forced ships to take goods to monopolized ports only, a problem that continued and was part of the early fight of the American Revolution. They wanted all trade to come back to England and only then be sold to the places they were exchanged so they could have a total monopoly over that. At the time, Charles also sold government titles for money. He attempted to force loans, including a forced loan on the city of London at large. He apparently had a list drawn up of all these different aldermen that he had deemed fit to lend to the king. Oh, thanks very much. And any aldermen on the list who refused to do that, to just lend the king money, were then imprisoned. He even had one of his lords confiscate the East India Company's stock of spices and then sold them off well below market value just to kind of cash in with a lukewarm promise to pay them back, you know, someday with interest in the future, eventually. He also went in and just straight up confiscated all the silver out of the National Mint in the Tower of London. That was everyone's currency and he just snatched it up. In another arena, Charles enlarged the boundaries of the Royal Forest Territory in contradiction to the seminal Carta de Foresta, the Charter of the Forest dating back to 1217, right around the time of the Magna Carta, which gave all free men rights of access to the Royal Forest. He tried to roll that back. And then he slapped fines on people for daring to use the forest in the way that had traditionally been the case. He implemented something called the Statute of Improvement, quote-unquote, to take large quantities of the common grounds without anyone's consent. Oh, and being as the king in England is also head of the Church of England, the crown itself is intermingled with the religious and spiritual aspects of the church. So it was considered a subject of the realm's religious duty to say prayers for the royals as part of church services, like a required spiritual tax. And your opinions on God and spirituality and on churches really haven't got anything to do with it. And in this capacity, Charles I also imposed new oaths on both the clergy and the lay people for, get this, the quote, maintenance of their own tyranny. Now there's a phrase. He had new liturgy drawn up to be read in church by requirement that went contrary to the interest of Parliament, to the rights of people and their liberties, and to the established laws of England. And if any of the ministers refused to take these oaths and lead people in these new prayers, not only was an army raised to attempt to force them to do so, but they faced censures of suspension, excommunication, and other penalties if they did not. There's even one line in these writings that simply says, the restraint of the liberties of the subjects in their habitation, trades, and other interests. The Grand Remonstrance numbers 204 items in all. That's a lot of detailed complaints against Charles I. It should be noted that number 64 claimed that the moniker Puritans also included, quote, all of those who desire to preserve the laws and liberties of the kingdom, end quote. So it's not exactly what you would consider to be a religious viewpoint. We're not just talking about pilgrims here. We're basically talking about political movements who were censored and punished in various ways if they dared to question the nature of power. According to Part 7 of the Durant series, The Story of Civilization, titled The Age of Reason Begins, those with differing religious beliefs who spoke out against the Anglican Church under Charles I were subjected to cruel and inhumane tortures, punishments, and imprisonments. So, again, that recalls the Eighth Amendment of the Bill of Rights and the whole idea that people had moved to the American colonies for greater religious freedom to avoid religious persecution. This is part of that story. The Star Chamber was the secretive extrajudicial body that ultimately went down in history for its reputation as a tool of political and social oppression, that wielded arbitrary power, was capable of levying accusations and punishing those in their inquisition with or without the pretense of law. Even the U.S. Supreme Court has noted that the existence of the Star Chamber was a direct inspiration for the Fifth Amendment of the Bill of Rights. For example, the Star Chamber indicted Puritan minister Alexander Layton for authoring a book that referred to the Anglican institution of bishops as satanic. Layton's torture and abuse included 15 weeks in irons, in solitary confinement in an unheated cell open to snow and rain, described as being full of rats and mice. His hair fell out and his skin began peeling off. He was tied to a stake and whipped 36 times on the naked skin on his back with a heavy cord. He was placed in a pillory for 2 hours in the November snow. He was branded in the face. His nose was slit. His ears were cut off. And then he was sentenced to life in imprisonment. In fact, it's incredibly disgusting just how many stories there are about people's ears being cut off as punishment by the church under Charles I's reign. As Americans, we hear quite a bit in school about the pursuit of religious freedom by these early pilgrims and people coming over to the new American colonies. Not so much about the ears being cut off, though. Paying a spiritual tax through mandatory religious worship as a, quote, duty, just for being a British subject to the crown of an absolute monarch tyrant, has to be one of the highest forms of taxation without representation or consent that's even possible. Because it's a tax on your soul. It goes against your own conscience, your own beliefs. If you go through this Grand Remonstrance document more thoroughly than this summation permits, you will find corollaries to basically all of the first 10 amendments to the American Bill of Rights all over this thing. There's a long, thoroughly documented history of monarchs violating these inherent rights long before they were enshrined and put to paper after the American Revolutionary War. Obviously, there was a buildup here. Almost forgot to mention that news and media were only allowed under royal license, and all information, especially about the crown, was tightly controlled. When it comes to the Grand Remonstrance, it's surprising Charles I even felt the need to reply at all, but in his short response rejecting the remonstrance, the king appeared to be the most upset that the House had directly printed copies for public distribution, noting that he was, quote, very sensible of the disrespect, end quote, of allowing the commoners to even know what had been said at all, than he was about actually responding to any of the specific allegations, because, again, as a divine absolute monarch, he didn't even feel like he was required to answer to these accusations, or answer to any other human being on earth at all whatsoever. So the Grand Remonstrance, because it dared to question the king in writing in such a public way and raise these issues and confront him, was a groundbreaking document. And as his relationship with Parliament continued to deteriorate after it was issued, Charles I raised an army. In response, the Parliament called for the militia. A civil war ultimately ensued, and the king was captured, put on house arrest, and then put on trial for high treason. He was charged with the, quote, wicked designs, wars, and evil practices that have been and are carried on for the personal advancement and upholding of a personal interest of will, power, and pretended prerogative to himself and his family against the public interest, common right, liberty, and peace of the people of this nation, end quote. So his charges were based around the dynamic of power in a fundamental way that addresses the philosophical points. The indictment held that Charles I was found guilty of all the treasons, murders, rapines, burning spoils, desolations, damages, and mischiefs to this nation, acted and committed in the said wars or occasioned thereby. Some 300,000 people had to die during the Civil War to get this point across that absolute monarchy is not okay. This is like 6% of the nation's population at the time, a very high price to pay. The king was found guilty and beheaded, and more importantly, the point made its way into history. But he was then replaced by Oliver Cromwell and his version of the Commonwealth, which was run by a military dictatorship. And in attempting to correct the imbalance brought about by the system of absolute monarchy, embodied quite literally by Charles I, the Puritans aspired towards a sort of democratic theocracy where the only distinctions among men were moral and religious, and there was no law but their interpretation of God's word. Puritans canceled all holidays as superstitious, and the theater, where they considered actresses to be whores, was closed down. In attempting to correct for the imbalance caused by absolute monarchy and what they felt were the loose morals of the age, they then overcorrected and took the imposition of their brand of religion and morality way too far in the opposite direction, ultimately showing themselves to be just as intolerant and dictatorial as those who had previously shown intolerance to them. And that overcorrection allowed for a vacuum of the people's sentiments to support the return of monarchy just after it had been brought down.
But the monarchy would be restored under his son, Charles II. A restoration which came complete with a touch of the mythical. The story about how Charles II escaped England unscathed as his father was dethroned has gone down as historical fact, even though it sounds like a fairy tale as good as anything Disney has ever concocted. The story goes that the future king had to hide from Cromwell's soldiers in an oak tree on September 6, 1651. After a failed bid to regain the throne at Worcester in the final conflict of the Civil War. This particular tree later came to be known as the Royal Oak, and the basis of a new government holiday and holy day within the Church of England called Oak Apple Day, May 29, 1660, the day of Charles II's 30th birthday, the very day they perfectly timed for his return to England to resurrect the monarchy 11 years after his dad was beheaded. If Charles III's name wasn't a significant enough symbolic connection, back on September 6, 2001, he even participated in a ceremony where the man who would become Charles III planted a descendant acorn from Charles II's royal oak right next to his predecessor on exactly the 350th anniversary of Charles II hiding in the oak tree from the soldiers. When Charles II was brought back, he didn't just restore the monarchy, however. He resurrected the aristocracy's political power in Britain in one fell swoop. The coronation was put off until St. George's Day the following year, the feast day of the patron saint of England, a powerful and important British holiday indeed to host what some still consider to this day to be the most consequential coronation ever to take place in British history. With the royal hereditary monarchy reinstated, certain royalists most loyal to Charles' father were rewarded with dukedoms, such as William Cavendish, Earl of Newcastle, who wrote a treatise on how Charles II should go about ensuring that the restoration took. And it's important to look at this so you can see the mindset through which this monarchy was being restored under Charles II. In the view of royalists of the time, the worst evil above all others in the attempt at abolishing monarchy and establishing a more republican form of government had apparently come from what they referred to as, quote, the mixing of classes. A set of two historical volumes entitled England Under King Charles II, published in 1934 by Oxford University at the Clarendon Press, sums it up. Quote, the immediate danger to the newly restored monarchy came from the towns, especially from the metropolis. London should therefore be disarmed and controlled by two forts, one on each side of the Thames. These precautions with a well-fortified tower would serve to keep the commercial classes in their place. As for commerce, the Duke stated that when everything is cheap, there's scarcity of money, and when everything is dear, there's plenty of money. It might therefore be deduced that it was good policy to keep prices, and therefore rents, high. Sound familiar? With means of physical control in place, quote, the next thing was to set in order religion. Lay preaching must be discouraged. Schoolmasters should be such only as the bishop's license. The parson is to preach weekly from a printed sermon, this being the work of either a bishop or a person approved by him. The episcopate thus provides the ruler with intermediaries through whom he can exercise control over both clergy and laity. But this is not the sole advantage of the Church of England for the purposes of statecraft. Religion, in fact, must be the first concern of the statesman, because the enthusiasm of the common people breeds revolution. The Duke wrote, quote, the Bible in English under every weaver's and chambermaid's arms hath done us much hurt. The power of education was also attacked for raising common consciousness to a level that was at complete odds with a system ruled by the marriage of church and state under a hereditary monarch presiding over a society that was basically a caste system, where the aristocracy wanted to make sure class distinctions were kept clear and the privileges of the nobility maintained. Quote, there are too many students at the universities. If the colleges had but half their numbers, these would be better fed and better taught. The same is true of the grammar schools, where syntaxes are well thumbed, while horse and plow are neglected. Consequently, the schools should limit their numbers, for their only justification is that they serve the needs of the church and those of the law and merchants. Education has its uses, but like everything else, there can be too much of it, end quote. Continuing on the unholy wedding of church and state, the Duke notes, quote, with the help of the church and the law, Englishmen would be kept in order, and a recurrence of such an episode as the interregnum made impossible. Thus, the bishops in their diocese should act as intelligencers, reporting to the government, while in the universities there should be spies to search out the unorthodox and the seditious. But I'm sure you probably think, listening to this, that none of these attitudes still applies today in contemporary society, right? Under Charles Toop, the Duke goes on to talk about how parliaments are only justifiable if the king was able to control them. Period. The permission to allow weekly news was also a problem because, quote, these journals filled the minds of the ignorant with their inflammatory domestic and foreign intelligence, end quote.
Paper, mister?
The king would have his invitation-only high mask rituals at Whitehall, as his father had done, and the derisive, air quote, meaner people out in the country would have their low-level folk rituals of maypole, Morris dancing, hobby horse, wassail at Christmas, to keep them happy in their places within this society, as the Duke noted that the, quote, poisonous humors against the king and his system could be sweated out through the folk rituals. The keynote of Newcastle social philosophy was, quote, ceremony and order with force governs all and keeps every man and everything within the circle of their own conditions. A societal loop, therefore, that most of society was doomed to. The Duke noted that under Elizabeth I's reign, just by the way, the Queen would appear in public gorgeously attired, pronouncing her benediction, God bless you, my good people. And the Duke highlighted the fact that these words were of no great matter and cost nothing to the crown. Quote, yet I assure your majesty, it went far with the people. The restoration came with the dissolution of the convention parliament shortly after Charles II's coronation, and the new Cavalier Parliament, made up of mostly royalists and Anglicans, was assembled, which went on to pass acts and require oaths to secure Anglican dominance and conformity in the nation. These acts came to be known as the Clarendon Codes, after Edward Hyde, Earl of Clarendon, a man who the text pointed out believed that religion was not a spiritual experience, but what he called a, quote, social cement that bound the subject of the king tightly to his place in the world. There's a theme here. They went on to pass several acts, and I think it's kind of important to note what these were. The Corporation Act of 1661 required municipal office holders to swear allegiance to the church, thus restricting the holding of any public office solely to members of the Church of England. The Act of Uniformity of 1662 made the Anglican Book of Common Prayer compulsory. In the new version, required under Charles II, they literally sainted his father, Charles I, as a martyr and made a required day of prayer to be held annually on the day of his execution as a reminder of the wicked evil done to such a goodly king. The church also created what came to be known as Oak Apple Day, as mentioned previously, celebrated annually on Charles II's birthday, in which it was the duty of all members of the church to carry out festivities energetically renewing the resurrection of the monarchy under Charles II each year. The holiday was officially discontinued in the 19th century, but it's still celebrated at some churches and institutions across England even today. And some churches would even haul a giant oak branch up to the top of their church in order to symbolically reiterate who and what is at the head of it. This is one of the prayers they added in the 1662 Book of Common Prayer for Thanksgiving for the return of Charles II. And there's an epistle in here, down here. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it says down here, "Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors. For so is the will of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king." The Conventicle Act of 1664 prohibited religious assemblies of more than 5 people unless they were officially under the auspices of the Church of England. The 5 Mile Act of 1665 expressly prohibited non-conforming clergymen from coming within 5 miles of the parish they'd been banished from for not conforming to Anglicanism. While the theater was brought back, which had been done away with under Cromwell, only those with theater licenses granted by the king were allowed to perform. And what they performed largely consisted of symbolic reenactments or celebrations of the restoration of the monarchy and aristocracy system. And for those of you who understand the true power of theater, you'll understand why that is. Just like his father Charles I, in the end Charles II dissolved Parliament in 1679 and ruled all by himself until he died of an apoplectic fit, which may or may not have been induced by poison, in 1685. 2 years before his death, at a meeting of convocation of the University of Oxford in July 1683, a decree was passed condemning certain, quote, pernicious books and damnable doctrines. Among the beliefs they condemned were the idea that civil authority is derived from the people, that there's a contract between the ruler and his subjects, and that a king who becomes a tyrant forfeits the obedience of his subjects. So in other words, none of that. If you believed any of those 3 things, those are damnable doctrines. Clarendon himself made no secret of the fact that he and his fellow royalists believed the rebellion that ended Charles I's reign could not be wholly destroyed until the king's inherent regal powers and prerogative were fully restored. The king's power was believed so extensive that its limits, quote, should not be inquired into, according again to this Oxford University published history book. Quote, "Its activities were also entitled to the protection of secrecy, for it was the law of the land that no one might expose to public knowledge anything concerning the government without a king's license." To the people in positions of actual power, the king wielded supreme jurisdiction in the state, while all others had merely delegated jurisdiction. The king alone was the supreme governor in all ecclesiastical and temporal causes. And the king was ordained by God. Both Charles I and II's reigns encompassed the last 2 modern attempts to uphold outright absolute monarchy in England. But we must take note of the fact that they also oversaw the greatest shifts in mass consciousness of men towards freedom from this unjust and outdated system of rule. The Magna Carta of 1215 was an earlier version, but did not subject the king to the rule of the people, the way that Charles I and II ultimately would. Absolute monarchy died completely during the Glorious Revolution of 1688, which led to the 1689 British Bill of Rights, establishing a so-called limited monarchy in England. Just 100 years before the American Revolution and Bill of Rights based on it would come to be here in America.
As I stand before you today, I cannot help but feel the weight of history which surrounds us.
Charles III will oversee a kingdom much larger than that of his two namesake predecessors combined. With some 2.4 billion subjects spread across 14 nations. But he's also coming to full power at a key moment in human history, during a massive transformation shifting us into a global society. And it was Charles III who announced the Great Reset at Davos in 2020 during the crises of the pandemic. The symbolic importance of this cannot be overstated. But it has led up to this moment that's been decades in the making. Royalty, the continuation of monarchy in a modern world of democracies, quote unquote. Even the British crown has found itself on the defensive. But in reality, the same arguments against its relevancy in a modern world, in fact, sustain its power and influence under the global system that's being set up. This archaic and obviously outmoded form of government is oddly perfect for a postmodern, post-industrial world based around a vast empire of commerce, planned economic production, personality influence, and media framing basically all discussions. And moving in this direction, communication has tended to produce a dominant image, exemplified even by the visage of the Queen, who's been such a chief product of the post-war TV broadcasting era that she almost became a sort of base signal of fidelity. A carrier image, the figurehead of a unifying message broadcast from the top down out across to the masses through the transmission of light.
All of that very much appealed to me as a 10-year-old child, because that coronation in this country ushered in the television age. People, for the first time, bought a television. My parents did, for £100, an HMV black and white set with a 12-inch screen. And somehow we managed to get 17 people from the little street we lived in into our back room, watching it for hours on end.
1.7 billion were there for his birth. 220 countries tuned in for his first step. And as he grew, so did the technology. An entire human life recorded on an intricate network of hidden cameras and broadcast live and unedited 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Thus, the British monarchy is quietly adapted in form and function to span the total of not just the physical globe, but the noosphere, penetrating the often media-generated and kept mental life of the population.
CBS News Special Report. I'm Nora O'Donnell. We are just moments away from one of the most majestic and historic things that many of us will see in our lifetime.
And royals reinvented for the transition from the post-war era to the post-industrial one have the potential to flourish in a tech-laden age where imagination is supposed to run free, but somehow intermediaries dominate the experience and always take a cut and have this controlling position. And so these royals are regenerating, as they have before in past ages, parallel with the expansion and evolution of transnational corporate business, of central banks, of merchant interest in the age of globalism, and under this global economy, bending around the matrix of sovereign nations, finding power in a different way in an end run around constitutional limits. Ambassadors of a global corporation that sees itself as one broad kingdom with no borders. Famously, the sun never set on the British Empire. The sun also would never set on this planetary empire. And so the bounds of powers, both potential and actual, expand effortlessly into an unkept, ungoverned frontier. Rules that are yet to be codified and restrictions that are yet to be levied. The United Nations and its predecessor, the League of Nations, etc., they're all just frameworks, they're mock-ups, they're trial runs that operate as a shell game within the rings of power, but they shape the conversation enough to deter and wall off growth into any other direction. It gives an indication of the governance, but the jurisdiction for that governance is not restricted.
this collusion between big tech and big government to censor dissenting voices, even the dissenting voices of scientists. Listen here to Melissa Fleming. She's the Undersecretary for Global Communications at the UN.
We partnered with Google, for example. If you Google climate change, you will, at the top of your search, you will get all kinds of UN resources. So we're becoming much more proactive. We own the science, and we think that the world, should know it. We own the science, and we think that the world should know it. We own the science.
With an earthly threat as pretext, imminent and all-encompassing, there are nascent jurisdictions which supersede the limits of nations and constitutional governing bodies that are now thriving. Like the British Empire before it, a global commonwealth has been placed over the local groupings of power. Act locally, think globally. You know the message. A supranational checkpoint that is beyond popular will, compatible with cooperative tributaries and vassals, yet capable of disrupting what won't be allowed in the new future being shaped right now. Take, for example, the Netherlands during this global reset. Prime Minister Mark Rutte, who's been a regular WEF attendee, has ushered in new laws in his nation and set up a new cabinet position to take on the environmental issue of drastically reducing nitrogen levels.
Klaus Schwab's golden pinup boy, Prime Minister Mark Rutte, is busy fulfilling the agenda of the World Economic Forum's Great Reset.
If they want to go to the goal, they're going to reduce 50% of the farmers here in Holland. And that's only the farming.
And the sudden, forceful nature of these laws is disrupting the economy.
We're also now getting reports that Italian farmers are rising up to protest in Rome. We are not slaves, we are farmers. We cannot make ends meet. But it's not just Italian farmers. Polish farmers are now protesting. So too are Spanish farmers. As too are disgruntled German farmers.
Shutting off food supply and production, but also jobs, and it's totally upended the status quo with very little notice.
This is taking place everywhere, and you can slate it all home to insane globalist climate change policies.
New Zealand has announced a welfare scheme that would see a tax introduced on emissions from burping farm animals. The move is part of the country's plan to tackle climate change.
An emissions tax to reduce greenhouse gases, we're better out than in, will soon be costing farmers. New Zealand's Prime Minister has unveiled a world-first strategy to tax emissions from burps and urination produced by farm animals.
To measure emissions, animals are placed in animal-friendly respiration chambers. Gas output is measured over 2 days through automated systems.
So pretty upset would be a mild understatement. The message I'm getting from farmers is we must oppose this.
So there's been a massive backlash, protests, nearly an uprising, and yet a firm hand that has been deaf to their pleas. It's purely monarchical. It's a new form of monarchy. And so at the level above that, for Charles III, the crown monarch, until quite recently and for the majority of his life, the Prince of Wales, this has meant nourishing countless organizations, repeating himself ad nauseum, using his prestige to get this agenda set in place. And through a half century of involvement with the United Nations, with Davos, and with all their spin-offs and counterparts, he's developed this type of forceful nurturing to address these environmental concerns and, make a campaign to rehabilitate the earth and push for these kind of policies like we've seen in the Netherlands. And it basically amounts to what appears to be Charles's core belief in himself.
We are reaching a global tipping point, as it has been mentioned many times here, in areas that are so close to the heart of His Royal Highness.
Or at least in the reflection that he perceives in the mirror as a kind of quasi-savior of the world.
With a growing global population creating ever-increasing demand on the planet's finite resources, we have to reduce emissions urgently and take action to tackle the carbon already in the atmosphere.
Leading to a broader effort, Charles III's crusades, if you will, his God-given mission, his great work for this environmental stuff.
The COVID-19 pandemic has shown us just how devastating a global cross-border threat can be. Climate change and biodiversity loss are no different. In fact, they pose an even greater existential threat, to the extent that we have to put ourselves on what might be called a warlike footing.
And this amounts to an emergency crisis that Charles himself claims necessitates a military-style response similar to the Marshall Plan that's required to combat climate change.
Here we need a vast military-style campaign to marshal the strength of the global private sector. With trillions at his disposal, far beyond global GDP.
And he repeated himself and doubled down, calling for a vast military-style campaign that would, quote, marshal the strength of the global private sector. Nothing short of what he calls a war against climate change.
As we tackle this crisis, our efforts cannot be a series of independent initiatives running in parallel. The scale and scope of the threat we face call for a global systems-level solution.
And of course, the solutions here are always flush with more powers for governing forces and for global bodies.
And with the greatest respect, beyond even the governments of the world's leaders.
He's called for a marshaled and deputized global private sector gathered together. You know, but it's a war against climate change, not for corporate profits, not for greenwashing huge fortunes, nope, for climate change. A forceful nurturing from our best and brightest, from our wealthiest and most elite.
We know this will take trillions, not billions of dollars.
The then Prince Charles called for a, quote, radical new world economy to tackle climate change. He endorsed the UN's COP26 agenda and reiterated their calls to, quote, mobilize finance to the tune of raising $100 billion and above for climate action. Those are fighting words, a military-style response. And going by a detailed look at his activities, appearances, and public statements over the past few decades, Prince Charles has been building up the globe from his shadow cabinet for the vast bulk of his life. There's no real end to the committees, the awards, the series of trusts, the appearances that start with the title The Prince's Foundation or that are connected to his friends in high finance that so frequently associate with him. As King Charles III, the former Prince of Wales, is now undergoing the most literal metamorphosis possible for a human, and as such, he must publicly step back from and distance himself from prior activities and boards. But today, with most of the British Empire lost since World War II to the cost of maintenance and the throne itself considered largely symbolic, King Charles III comes into his crown without any real need for it. His fellow travelers have already coated the earth with tiny ropes and the web spread strategically, planting the seeds of control for the maturing oaks of environmental jurisdiction at large. A plan for supranational, total global governance has long been underway. The, quote, sustainable and biodiverse earth that is off limits to commoners, but held in trust by a non-elective quasi-governmental body set up by a corporate elite. It isn't pure monarchy, and Charles wouldn't hold ultimate power, but the system he's helped bring into fruition is a potent remix of the chartered powers that were stylistically typical of the crown, and which ultimately empower both plutocracy and monarchy. A para-government with arbitrary power operating without boundaries, yet claiming tangible jurisdiction and a domain via global environmental threats that also know no state boundaries. It's an ultimate ring of power, but not one that has a mandate from the people. No great charter, no constitution, no consent, no duties except those towards the environment, a pretext that always assumes too many people using too much power and energy. If successful, it will be a renaissance of the feudal landlord age, a golden age for most of the elite, controls on human behavior, restrictions on personal access to shopping, public places, businesses, restrictions on travel, mandatory screenings, submission to experimental treatments, forced changes in diets.
Right. Let's see which one of us can touch his toes. Right over from the hips, brothers and sisters, please.
One, two.
Even an arbitrary tax on breathing is no exaggeration. And even if most of these powers aren't used on a day-to-day basis, the idea that they've been tested and legitimized is super creepy. But suck it up. Stop asking questions. Silence your publications. Show respect for the monarch. Show respect for your rulers, for the earth. Respect the crown. But keep a dignified demeanor. Adjustments to your personal lives, they're for the greater good. It's your duty. But authorized by who? And on what authority? The excesses at the top, meanwhile, are easily written off on the balance sheets. Offset, of course. Forced down the throats of the people through a media blitz of decades. Economic Forum, the UN, or the Club of Rome, which actually declared mankind itself to be the enemy.
In searching for a new enemy to unite us, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine and the like would fit the bill. All these dangers are caused by human intervention, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself.
But also, centuries ago in Royal England, under Thomas Malthus, who emphasized the supposed mathematical certainty of the population outstripping the food supply, a surefire formula he used to advocate a covert genocide against the masses of poor. He did so with the tacit endorsement of the dominant aristocracy, who benefited the most from Malthus's eugenical worldview, upholding their own view of superiority genetically as a stock, as a breed, of the upper classes against the misfit population he viewed in proto-scientific terms as something like a backwater best bleached from the earth. These views were reworked over the years, cleaned up a little, yeah, but have continued to resurface. It lent itself to a seemingly scientific and modern reinforcement of the supposed superiority of the upper classes. And the crown itself is so eugenically bolstered to the exclusion of everyone else that the royals theoretically hold true both a divine superiority with their hereditary bloodline selected by God for perpetual and unquestionable preference, and by a genetic superiority derived from the triumphs of Darwin's fittest, particular to their bloodline and race, well-born eugenics to its fullest. A religious and scientific pedigree. A social evolution where all meaningful levers of power are squarely landed with a landed class, a tiny, elect, and well-pruned, well-born group of peers. And don't forget, Philip claimed he wanted to be resurrected as a virus. Oh yes, it's in the book If I Were an Animal.
The basis of it all is this colossal increase in the human population. It's one of the living species of the planet, but it's reaching plague proportions.
HRH, the Prince of Wales, now out of waiting and claiming his rightful title as His Royal Majesty, continues the work of his father, Prince Philip, who co-founded the World Wildlife Fund, the WWF, which traded most of all in mental pictures, poster images of endangered animals and imperiled habitats in desperate need of intervention, putting a panda's morbidly cute face over the shadier work of managing the human population, restricting land preserves, and thus tugging again at the age-old feud between the common people and monarchs over land usage.
So now the next thing which is happening in Austria and also in Germany is that people are going into the forest and collect some firewood. In most forests, which is private property here in Austria and Germany, this is not allowed. Even if it's a forest which is owned by the government, you still have to get permission. So you cannot just go into the forest and pick up some branches because it's all private property. And if you do not have the permission, then it's stealing. They have made a special law in Austria that you can walk in every private forest, but you're not allowed to collect firewood without the permission. And that's what's happening now. And that's because the firewood price in Europe has surged.
The relationship between land usage and the rights of the people notably dates back to King John and his dispute with the lords who demanded the Magna Carta. This is some Robin Hood shit. More recent monarchs, Charles I in particular, have tried since that time to once again impinge on the age-old rights of the forest, which directly affects common people. He used it to raise prices and deny resources to those people, basically spiting their lives. And yet, centuries later, after all those challenges to the kings, the legal history of basic rights for ordinary people, after the need to restrain arbitrary powers had already been worked out, we somehow find ourselves in the position where a similar note is being struck at scale with the entire earth as we know it. And Charles' personal vision for sustainable energy and planned cities in the way he sees it, and how it contrasts so sharply with the hordes of people who just want to be able to afford fuel, their homes, food, at prices they could afford for their families, who are at this very time facing economic and energy crises. Instead of reading the room and grasping these very real problems, acknowledging the issues of ordinary people and the insane levels of inequality between ordinary people and billionaires who were swaying the entire public conversation, instead of understanding that people are wary of further controls under any pretext, tone-deaf Charles, in 2021, just ahead of becoming king, unveiled his very own, quote, Terra Carta, a document he created that I see as an inversion of the Magna Carta and the balance of power set up ages ago back in the 13th century to restrain the arbitrary powers of monarchs. Implicitly rejecting that tradition in the very vein of his two former namesakes, Charles I and II, Charles III's Terra Carta bypasses the people he supposedly governs, instead putting the earth into the contract, the charter, the agreement, the earth, in quotes, and setting aside the precedents for social contracts and the balance of power with people, relative fairness, relative freedom in their affairs, with respect to the issues they've had with monarchs all throughout history, time after time. Watch those Shakespeare history plays. It's all that stuff. And the Terra Carta is all the creepier because it could be voluntarily ascribed to by corporate partners who agree to honor its top-down principles and in return are in the position of having preferential business with research and development labs, the innovators of these climate mitigation technologies and these big earth-sized solutions, in partnership with Charles's own Terra Carta design lab. And by the way, Charles's Terra Carta Design Lab, their most recent innovation, is a plan for methane-converting gas masks to be worn by livestock and cattle. Take a look at that image. With the weight of a royal title, Charles as Prince of Wales has long leveraged his influence with a group of corporate partners who have extremely deep pockets. Those who are and have been aiming to transform the world through their partnerships, which usually reap them preferential business deals, you know, whatever, for the earth, almost to the point of the royal monopolies that were issued under King Charles I centuries ago. You know, policies to help them manifest their tightly regulated visions of, quote, sustainable living. But all those tentacles of power, those ships, they've all sailed. They're in place. They're positioned. Charles, as crowned king, need not say word one. He can comfortably keep with the appearance of being a ceremonial monarch only, and especially with respect to not interfering with the affairs of Britain. The causes he's contributed to have already shaped the agenda, and the collaboration of a feast of thieves gathered around the golden goose of sustainability, environment, climate change, prestidigitation has already commenced. I mean, the big moment at WEF 2020, he didn't just promote the Great Reset, he was crowned by that agenda. He announced it to the world in the appearance of being a monarch, you know, during this WEF 2020, where he was sort of king of the world with this issue. It was in that context that he announced the beginning of the Great Reset agenda, officially launched there at WEF 2020 with all the other people that are connected to it.
Please welcome His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales. Ladies and gentlemen, I am most touched that Professor Klaus Schwab should have invited me to be with you as we mark the 50th anniversary of the World Economic Forum and its mission to improve the state of the world. It is this mission and the urgent need to shape the next 50 years that has inspired me to be with you here today.
Real quick, I just want to point this out because I noticed it and I can't unsee it now. They didn't just crown His Royal Majesty at the 50th anniversary of the 2020 WEF meeting where Charles, not Klaus Schwab, who officially formally announced the Great Reset. We live in such a video game at this point that they literally went out of their way to crown him with the United Nations 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. So check out his ginormous rainbow fleur-de-lis crown here. You think that there'd easily be three sections of six lines to make this graphic, but no, the middle section only has five for a total of 17 lines. And where have you seen that number? Well, you have a total of 17 sustainable goals on this UN Global Goals chart, each one being a different shade of a color. And no two are the exact same color. Now look at his crown. There are four blue lines. You also have four blue goals, corresponding to those shades of blue. There's three green ones for the three green goals, three yellow shades for those, and the rest are shades of orange, red, and pink. I mean, what I'm saying is they actually went to the trouble of having a graphic designer sit over there somewhere in a cubicle and make each line in Charles WEF crown to correspond to the shade of a color of one of these UN SDGs for this speech where, again, it isn't Klaus Schwab announcing the Great Reset, but His Royal Majesty over there telling everyone what the agenda to shape the future is about to look like.
The urgent need to shape the next 50 years that has inspired me.
The fact that they took it that far to literally crown him the majesty of the UN's 2030 goals is making a pretty bold statement about who this man is and what his role is going to be for the future they're shaping and building here, don't you think? I mean, likewise, the United Nations has also used this graphic for their General Assembly meetings, where they have these giant screens on the wall in the main room where all the representatives meet, where the goals themselves are ticked out like a clock around the entire Earth, and they have it suspended in outer space. So the colors then come down around the walls as if they're surrounding the UN representatives down on the floor. So when Charles wears this crown in front of everyone at WEF, I'm just saying, could they be any more literal with this symbolism of what they're trying to say here? So you have two unelected, supranational, global bodies now crowning a hereditary monarch in goals with words like justice and equality. King of the world!
I'm the king of the world!
It just doesn't get more ironic. The level of this irony is so great that I feel like if anything else was added to it, it would implode and create a black hole that would destroy all of reality. Remember back in 1987 at an address to the UN General Assembly when President Ronald Reagan said that line about how our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world?
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
Well, they've got that idea covered now in the framing of the climate threat and how no matter what governments do individually, even if they're doing them at the same time,
our efforts cannot be a series of independent initiatives running in parallel.
It has to be a global thing.
A global cross-border threat
that supersedes national boundaries.
Beyond even the governments of the world's leaders.
Which is going to require more money than the entire world's GDP.
This will take trillions, not billions of dollars. Far beyond global GDP.
Or it simply won't work.
For a global systems-level solution.
So instead of worrying about how some emotionless, psychopathic aliens from, say, the TV show V are going to show up here and unhinge their jaws like an Oral-B commercial and eat guinea pigs while they set up a global military dictatorship, now we're just going to get unelected hereditary monarchs.
The Prince of Wales has grown up in such a privileged lifestyle. Everything is done for him. His pajamas are pressed every morning. His shoelaces are pressed flat with an iron.
Who literally don't even put the toothpaste on their own toothbrush when they brush their teeth.
Prince Charles does have his valet squeeze 1 inch of toothpaste onto his toothbrush every morning. If anyone gets anything wrong, everybody is scolded.
To lecture us all on global bodies of power.
Taxes, policies and regulation
that need trillions of dollars.
Trillions, not billions of dollars.
To quote, level the playing field.
It is time to level the playing field.
Like we're supposed to believe a man so pampered he can't even turn the knob on his bathtub to fill up his own bathwater.
The water temperature has to be just tepid and only half full.
Knows anything about a level playing field or has any remote clue of what the playing field even is.
And to the encouragement of corporate social and environmental responsibility.
On one occasion, he rang me from his library and he said, Paul, a letter from the Queen seems to have fallen into my waste paper bin. Would you pick it out? The waste paper bin was there. He was sat there. I had to bend down into the paper bin, pick out the letter, put it back on his desk. Will that be all, Your Royal Highness?
Or any concept whatever on what the average person thinks or feels or wants or needs or cares about in this world.
A vast military-style campaign, a warlike footing, with trillions at his disposal.
Will that be all, Your Royal Highness?
And by the way, this entire Marshall Plan part of Charles' UN climate conference speech last November might sound just a teens bit familiar, as it's basically plagiarized from the speech given by Baron Edmund de Rothschild back in 1992 at the UNCED conference, also known as the Rio Earth Summit.
But perhaps this conference might like to think more about the Marshall Plan, which had been mooted and put forward very tentatively at the Denver conference. And perhaps this might be the keynote of what you have heard today and what perhaps you might like, in some perhaps amended form, to have put forward by her Brundtland report, which has been widely circulated to world leaders. She could follow up this report with the recommendations to promote a second Marshall Plan, the third world debt relief, and finance for a stable development.
Funny how that works, isn't it? On a side note, do you ever notice that these speeches that the people they keep panning to in the audience all look like they're being held hostage? I mean, look at these people. Look at Boris. He's like, please, I just want some water. I'm so thirsty. I'll do whatever you say. Just let me see my family again. Please. Well, Charles drones on and on about the issue is the sustainable markets. The markets must be sustainable. I'm like, please, my soul is decaying inside my body. Please, please make him stop talking, please. I just want to go home.
In his promotion of the Great Reset back in 2020, Charles himself identified the pandemic crisis, aptly termed Corona, aka Crown, as a, quote, golden opportunity. An opportunity, he said, to, quote, seize something good from the crisis. A sort of you're our only hope, Obi-Wan Kenobi, for salvation.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Give us a global government's kind of announcement.
We have no alternative because otherwise, unless we take the action necessary and we build again in a greener and more sustainable and more inclusive way, then we will end up having more and more pandemics and more disasters.
This is our most desperate hour.
He said that the pandemic, which has forced governments worldwide to mothball their economies, had showed people that dramatic change was possible. This pandemic, as part of the Great Reset, the rebooting of the economy, showed the powers that could be exercised at the global level, showed that the people and the people's governments were to be subservient to a new type of crown. And when he announced the Great Reset and promoted its agenda, he didn't just promote it. He was under a crown. He was crowned by the agenda, and his partnership with WEF included recognizing his position as a sort of global monarch, at least symbolically. And that's nothing new. He held a similar motivation when he appeared via hologram at a conference in 2008 to show that he was environmental yet distantly aloof, while at the same time promoting sustainability and heralding a new age where energy would be saved by limiting travel.
To vanish into thin air and leave not a carbon footprint behind.
Fuel and time would be saved by teleconferencing and business, and by having a metaverse type of presence in the very near future, together but separate, distant yet connected, ad nauseum. Obi-Wan, hubby, you're my only hope. Whereas previous kings have sometimes needed to imprison dissenters or hang a few rogues to garner proper respect for their dictates, the monarchs of today can witness entire nation-states and economies held hostage by a global crisis, an imperiling emergency that can comfortably supersede the sovereignty of all together under a planetary uh-oh of unimaginable proportions. As we move from rescue to recovery, therefore, we have a unique but rapidly shrinking window of opportunity to learn lessons and reset ourselves on a more sustainable path. It is an opportunity we have never had before and may never have again. We must use all the levers we have at our disposal, knowing that each and every one of us has a vital role to play. End quote. Charles Mountbatten, Windsor. Now, just one last thing. I submit that just as Charles II fought to restore monarchy with an axe to grind about his father, Charles III is fighting to restore the powers of monarchy that has become limited after centuries of political, social, and technological changes that have fundamentally altered the structures and balance of power, and they want it back.
So with 2020 being seen as the super year.
If you tried to play a drinking game for every time this man says sustainable markets, you would die within probably less than 2 minutes flat.
I am delighted to be launching a sustainable markets initiative. Sustainable markets and markets rooted in sustainability. Within sustainable markets, the sustainable markets approach, shifting our default setting to sustainable. Sustainable markets of sustainable markets. Sustainable markets framework creates sustainable markets that bring sustainable markets into focus through the lens of sustainable markets. In accelerating the transition to sustainable markets, I have made sustainable markets my priority. Sustainable markets.
Most of this speech is your typical buzz phrase word salad of environmental platitudes that, you know, some group of PR people sit around in one of those trendy offices with the bouncy balls for chairs and they drink matcha lattes and, you know, they pull out a thesaurus and come up with these words that, I mean, it sounds like it means something.
As I've been trying to say for quite a long time, systems level framework, global value creation, outlining responsible transition pathways to a circular bioeconomy.
But after you listen to it for a good 10 minutes, let alone half an hour,
long-standing incentive structures,
it's unclear as to whether anything of substance has really been said at all.
Identifying game changers, moving together with clear roadmaps, a business model approach to revenue generation, connecting investments to investables.
Seriously though, while half of this speech sounds like it's the kind of word salad that comes from feeding 30 years of WEF meetings into an AI and just reading whatever script it generates,
Investments or the wider enabling environment,
the other half is laden with some pretty heavy implications.
Through new technologies, we have the ability to tag, track, and trace supply chains in unprecedented ways.
I mean, we have a monarch, crowned, literally in the UN SDGs up there, openly declaring plans to use taxes, policies, regulations, and financial incentives,
reorientating economic subsidies, financial incentives, and regulations can have a dramatic and transformative effect on our market systems.
Which, of course, go both ways. To alter and control behavior in regard to resources toward an agenda.
Human and financial capital.
I mean, literally every history lesson you ever learned about how this goes bad is this right here yet again. It's just they got new words, new buzz phrases, new terms that dress it up for the 21st century.
Nature, ladies and gentlemen, is not a separate asset class.
For example, when he talks about the regenerated forests,
providing, at last, the economic incentive to value the vastly important ecosystem services provided by the immense biodiversity and carbon capture potential of restored and expanded forests.
I can only imagine what it must have felt like to live in the Robin Hood days, prior to the Charter of the Forest, where the king always comes up with a way that people are denied access to the things.
Of restored and expanded forests.
Greetings, Your Highness.
Enough! King, illegal forest, too pig, wild, kill in it as is.
What?
There's always a pretense, always a reason to deny people access to the resources they need to live, whether it be by premiums, fines, or outright restrictions. No matter what the reason supposedly is.
But now, it is time to take it to the next level.
So here we are, guys, in 2022.
And as this digital global age coalesces,
we literally have yet another king.
We have to put ourselves on what might be called a warlike footing.
Talking about using the powers of taxation,
how we properly deploy taxes,
and war.
Here we need a vast military-style campaign
to oversee societal transformation
with trillions at his disposal, far beyond global GDP,
and, quote, shape the world.
The urgent need to shape the next 50 years that has inspired me.
And shape the world in his image.
Like a god on earth. Same as it ever was.
How we properly deploy taxes.
Taxes!
Taxes.
Beautiful, lovely taxes.
Taxes.
Going back hundreds of years.
Eons. Millennia, whatever.
Yet another king is overseeing the implementation of yet another unpopular, illegitimate control system that, like those of his other two named predecessors, will also have to be wholly rejected if the peoples of this world are ever to be truly free. As you could see, this system is supranational. It goes beyond the bounds of the political system within his own kingdom, or the Commonwealth, or any of that, to something that is being implemented worldwide, above and outside of governments.
Ladies and gentlemen, we all pull together in a coordinated global initiative to tackle the greatest global threat, and with the greatest respect, beyond even the governments of the world's leaders.
Just like no one voted for the representatives at the World Economic Forum or the people who run the United Nations, neither did anyone, including the citizens within Great Britain, ever actually consent to this king. They don't have to, because that's the way that system works. He's, quote, royal blood, so he just gets to be there.
When they announced Charles to be our only rightful lord and king, that isn't something I felt I should accept in the 21st century. I appreciate other people have different views. So I called out who elected him. A couple of people near me told me to shut up. Fair enough, that's their free speech.
Yeah.
I responded by expressing why I thought we shouldn't have a head of state without being consulted. And then suddenly there were these three security guards grabbing me, pushing me backwards. Then the police took hold of me, led me away, arrested me, handcuffed me, apparently for expressing an opinion.
Our only lawful and rightful lead lord, Charles the Third.
When they announced Charles to be our only rightful lord and king, this is something I felt I should accept in the 21st century. I called out who elected him. The police took hold of me, arrested me, handcuffed me.
And obedience.
Apparently for expressing an opinion.
And obedience.
For expressing an opinion.
And obedience. And obedience. And obedience. And obedience. And obedience.
Alan Brody, author of The English Mummers and Their Plays, Traces of Ancient Mystery, ritual is not designed to be meaningful to the audience. The rituals aren't for them. Oh, they need the audience there when they're up there Harry Pottering and whatever. They need the audience's participation. They need the energy of that audience. But for the audience, it's ceremonial. That need of their participation does not extend to the need of them understanding why that ritual is being performed, or what the ultimate purpose of that ritual actually is. Every time a high ritual in the magnitude of a monarch's coronation is performed, it is connected in time and space to, and its power multiplied by, every other performance of that same ritual. That's how rituals work. That is why the British system goes out of its way to maintain a strict protocol that ensures everything is as exact as it has been in coronations past. From the locations, to the specific garments and regalia used, their blessing and sanctification, and what order they're applied, to the order of the processions, to the way the altar's laid out, to the prayers made, oaths taken, songs sung, right down to the symbolism of the different crystals in the coronation crown, each of which has its own very specific meaning.
Other countries still have a monarchy, but very, very few have a medieval, in fact, none has a medieval coronation in the way that we do.
The coronation ceremony, a religious mass referred to by the BBC as, quote, the symbolic high point of the king's accession, is a religious initiation ritual carried out to invest and legitimize the king, sanctifying him as a sacred vassal to embody the spirit of their system. Coronations in Britain have been taking place at Westminster Abbey since William the Conqueror was crowned in 1066. All but two monarchs since then have been crowned there, each new ceremony building on the last and the past. The 5-pound solid gold-framed crown covered in jewels that will be placed on Charles III's head is known as St. Edward's Crown, named after former King Edward the Confessor, who was later sainted by the Anglican Church and canonized by the Pope. The Abbey claimed that Edward left a set of coronation regalia to be used at the coronations of all future monarchs. And following St. Edward's canonization, these items were considered holy relics. They were continually in use up until Oliver Cromwell's men thoroughly destroyed them after Charles I was found guilty of high treason and beheaded. For Charles II's coronation that would resurrect the monarchy, they dug up sometimes ancient manuscripts in order to recreate each and every piece necessary for the ritual down to as exact specifications as were possible. It is those pieces recreated for Charles II's coronation in 1661 that have been used ever since and will be brought back once again for Charles III's upcoming ceremony.
The all is an expression of religious and moral authority.
The royal family's links to slavery began during the reign of Queen Elizabeth I. The crown and the royal family was deeply involved in the slave trade and making money off the slave trade.
The all is an expression of religious and moral authority.
Charles II granted a charter to the royal adventurers originally, and they were then reconstituted as the Royal African Company to deal directly in enslaved Africans and to sell them in the New World.
The all is an expression of moral authority.
That suffering was not only immense, it was generational. And a lot of wealth was derived from the suffering.
The all is an expression of religious and moral authority.
The brands that were used on the bodies of enslaved people featured the name of monarchs. So, for example, the Duke of York, one of the brands that was used by the Royal African Company was the letters DY. And this was actually instructed to be put onto the bodies of enslaved people.
All is an expression of religious and moral authority.
Well, I'm sorry, we obviously have one or two problems with getting to our program. We hope to join it in just a few seconds. In the meantime, a bit of music.
Well, once again, let me just keep you informed that we are having to change machines to bring you the rest of this film. All will be well, we are told, in a few seconds' time. And just as soon as we go back to the film, as soon as it's running, we'll go back to it. Well, things seem to be much better now, except for Richard Harris, who's still having a fairly tough time of things. We rejoin the film just where we left it. Nothing missed.
You know, I think a lot of people don't realize how good prunes really are.
St. Edward's crown, by the way, is only worn once by each monarch and only during this moment.
For many, the role of the crown jewels has been largely forgotten after 65 years without a coronation.
According to The Drama of Coronation by Alice Hunt, a scholarly work published by Cambridge University Press that analyzed medieval coronation ceremonies, a function of the coronation is to, quote, render the invisible visible, to make outward appearances reflect inward reality. The objects of regalia embody sacred kingship through recalling St. Edward, which are carried aloft in a processional. It is, quote, the notion of the regalia's connection with the past and the role that each piece will fulfill in the forthcoming sacred service that matters most.
And the sovereign scepter, a beautifully jeweled emblem of kingly power, with its 530 carat diamond,
largest of the four stars of Africa.
In an interview a few days ago, royal expert Katie Nicholl told Entertainment Tonight that the scepter, orb, and imperial crown are, quote, probably the most important symbols of monarchy, and that the cross inscribed on both the scepter and the orb reflects the monarchy and the God-given right to monarchy.
They're not just objects of tremendous beauty and skill and craftsmanship and so on. They are an expression of the way in which authority has worked in this country, the relationship between the sovereign and the subject.
During coronation, the monarch, referred to as the undoubted heir, is made sacred through anointing with a specially prepared, blessed, sanctifying oil before being crowned. The anointing is considered the most sacred of all coronation rituals. The prayers uttered by the Archbishop of Canterbury prior to the anointing allude to the descent of the Holy Spirit and granting of a supernal grace upon the monarch. According to Hunt, the prayers spoken at coronation invoke biblical precedents of Abraham, Moses, Joshua, Solomon, and David. And, quote, the language of the prayers appeals to the tangibility of grace and the efficacy of the oil. She went to great lengths to make the case that this anointing, which is said to be what makes the monarch legitimate, is considered to be by God, infused with God's grace and equated with his anointed biblical forefathers. Quote, it is the oil that makes priests and kings, and it is through anointing. Once the monarch is anointed, Hunt points out, the prayer Deus de Filius stresses the physical transformation into king or queen brought about by the oil. She clarifies, the oil is not invoked as a symbol of God's grace. It is God's grace in material form. Continuing, quote, further physical transformation of the body of the king is invoked through the visible dressing of the king in his coronation robes. The monarch is then built up in front of the congregation with each new layer of regalia, a piece at a time, object by blessed and consecrated object, including a mantle, quote, representative of the earthly monarchical power derived from God.
A majesty being now anointed, wearing the colobium syndonis and the super tunica or close pall of cloth of gold, together with a girdle of the same, is seated once more in King Edward's chair.
Each exoteric item has a precise symbolism correlated to its esoteric attributes. As without, so within. Finally, the monarch is crowned. As the prayer Coronae Te Deus Corona Glory makes clear, ultimately, it is God who crowns the king. And she also went on to point out, the regalia items are basically magical vestments considered so powerful they confer virtues to the monarch that he or she does not already have.
Receive this imperial robe. The Lord your God endue you with knowledge and wisdom, with majesty and with power from on high. The Lord clothe you with the robe of righteousness and with the garment of salvation.
Quote, the blessing of each garment and object and the accompanying consecratory prayers transfer the gifts and virtues of kingly governance, as if held in their very fabric. The language does not express the bestowal of royal clothes as symbols of kingly virtues already possessed, but bestows them as consecrated objects, as sacred embodiments of those virtues. Similarly, the objects of the regalia are inextricable from the rites of the office they symbolize. They constitute those very rites.
Then shall the orb with the cross be brought from the altar by the Dean of Westminster and delivered into the Queen's right hand by the Archbishop.
The coronation processional through London serves an important ritual purpose as well. This processional is where the monarch is recognized and publicly acclaimed by his people, and with further ritual purpose, this civic acclamation celebrates the divinity of the king. That is its purpose. As an American, I have to ask, how can a political system be considered legitimate authority when the monarch ruling over it is thought to be a divine appointed by God? What mere mortals could ever really challenge the king or queen, or anything, if that's the structure of the system they claim to rule by?
I have been generous up until now, but I can be cruel.
Generous? What have you done that's generous?
Everything.
Plans for Charles III's coronation, which the mainstream media are reporting will likely take place in the spring or summer of 2023... during the 70th anniversary year of Queen Elizabeth II's coronation, have already been in the planning stages for years now. I think I saw somewhere they said they've been planning this since 2015. They've been planning this for years. Under the code name Operation Golden Orb.
An expression of
Marlo.
Scottish authorities have confirmed that the Stone of Scone, or ancient stone weighing in at exactly 336 pounds, upon which Scottish kings have been crowned for centuries, will be brought down for Charles' coronation throne. The ceremony will reportedly be toned down from that of his mother's to reflect Charles' vision for a slimmed-down, more modern monarchy. The ceremony is paid for by the government, and the government is in turn paid for by the people. They're calling it a cost-of-living coronation that promises to reflect the ethnic diversity of modern Britain, to include religious leaders from all over the world. They have announced that the anointing will take place at this coronation. And there are people out there who claim that this is just a ceremonial thing. It doesn't really have any power or meaning anymore. If that's the case, why have it at all? Why spend hundreds of millions of dollars to continue to prop it up? Why continue to go through all of these extremely high rituals? That argument makes no sense even on its face, let alone when you actually look into it. CBS News here in the States reported that the coronation ceremony is religious and symbolic, but not a constitutional requirement, and Charles III is no less the king for not having been through the process yet. Which I think is a very interesting statement that directly contradicts 20th century scholarly publications, such as this limited edition work detailing the coronation order of King James I, edited by a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians and the Society of Antiquaries, wherein the coronation was described as, quote, not a mere pageant, but a needful solemn inauguration of the new king. Not a mere device for the amusement of the people, but the real and serious admission of the king to the performance of his duties and consecration to his great office. Until the king was consecrated and crowned, he was not really king, only king-elect. The coronation is described as, quote, a rite of the utmost moment, partaking in some sort of sacramental character. Without it, the king was not a king at all, or king only in a very imperfect sense. The king was put into actual possession of the royal office only by the ecclesiastical consecration.
Just fear me, love me, do as I say, and I will be your slave.
My kingdom is great.
Coronation is perhaps the highest ritual ever performed in England, or at least that the public knows about. But there's something else that this ritual does, with all its ceremonial links going back not just over 1,000 years of British kings and queens, but they claim it goes back to the Old Testament days of anointing kings, despite, as Thomas Paine pointed out in Common Sense, God's direct warning that having kings would totally suck. King Charles III's coronation says to the rest of the world, unequivocally, mincing no words, that King Charles is God's anointed on earth, above all other men, period. As the Online Library of Liberty points out, this pageantry of royal events does not hide some of its most unappealing aspects, namely its disregard for the notion of the equal and inalienable rights of man, the idea that political sovereignty can be passed down from one generation to the next through a bloodline, and that any legitimate sovereign has an equal right to that political power, regardless of their skills, capacities, or moral character. And I've seen people online in recent days making jokes about how Charles won the birth lottery. But all jokes aside, such a system as divine hereditary monarchy invalidates the very idea of human equality. The anointing of King Charles as God's divine representative on earth stands in direct contradiction of ideas we enshrine here in America in documents like our Declaration of Independence, where it was written, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed."
To whom we do acknowledge all faith and obedience.
How can we affirm all humans are created equal when certain humans in power are claiming divine status to rule over the rest of us, over the rest of the world?
You have no power over me. You have no power.
As I said before, history has shown such imbalanced systems never remain that way for long.